Good morning, everyone, and welcome to Thursday Morning Roundtable. My name is Emily Winicky, and I'm the Community Engagement Coordinator here at Syracuse University. I would like to begin, as we do with all Syracuse University events, by acknowledging with respect the Onondaga Nation, firekeepers of the Haudenosaunee, the Indigenous people on whose ancestral lands Syracuse University now stands. I am now honored to introduce this morning's speaker, Onondaga County Executive Ryan McMahon. County Executive J. Ryan McMahon II is the fourth county executive. He assumed office on November 2, 2018. Ryan is a graduate of Bishop Ludden High School and Lemoyne College. He grew up in the Strathmore neighborhood in Syracuse and currently resides in the Winkworth neighborhood with his wife and three children. Ryan started his career in public service as a Syracuse City Councilor in 2005 after being elected at the age of 25. He was re-elected in 2007 for a second term and quickly earned a reputation as a bipartisan problem solver. In 2011, County Executive McMahon was elected to the 15th District of the Onondaga County Legislature, which includes portions of the City of Syracuse, the Town of Geddes, and the Town of Onondaga. Ryan was subsequently elected Chairman of the County Legislature in 2012 by his fellow legislators, becoming the youngest chairman in county history. As chairman, his primary focus was job creation and ensuring good fiscal discipline in the county. Under his leadership, property taxes were brought down to historic lows. Upon taking office as county executive, Ryan McMahon has placed a focus on three main initiatives: poverty, infrastructure, and economic development. Please join me in welcoming County Executive Ryan McMahon.
Good morning, and thank you. This is so... I think I saw a good friend of mine, Peggy Chase, on the picture. There's Peggy. Peggy had one of the greatest lines or quotes given by anybody during the pandemic when she said she's sick of Zooms. And so I think it's tough. This pandemic's been tough. And what I thought I would talk about a little bit is kind of, we'll go through where we are with COVID-19 and kind of go back and give you a little bit of perspective from the beginning, kind of where we are right now as we all struggle to find our balance. And, you know, just go through some of the impacts that we've had. What does it all mean after being in this pandemic for a year? Fiscally, what did it do to us? We just had, you know, essentially had a budget. And that budget was a grim reflection on really the impacts of the pandemic in 2020. So certainly, thank you for being here. Hopefully everybody's doing well. Hopefully everybody's safe and their families are safe as the pandemic continues to rage at this point. I know there's many, many families that are being impacted in the second wave that weren't in the first wave, including my own. And so this is something that is very serious. And in the beginning, when we started this, we did plan and prepare quite early for this in the beginning of the year when we learned about it. We have an emergency management department that actually in their training, they actually train for a biological type event. So they don't train for a hurricane, they don't train for a tornado. You do some training for terrorism, but the main base of their training is like a biological event. So this wasn't too far off of it. But as county executive, I get through, I was county executive for a year. I won a 4-year term. We go into 2020, we're riding high. We had our state of the county address where we put out a bold agenda for the county legislature to consider. And then next thing we know, COVID-19's impacting our community. And interestingly enough, we start to plan and prepare. We don't know if this is going to come to the U.S. We don't know if it's going to come to New York or make its way to Central New York. So we're moving on. So I'm out in actually Seattle, Washington, a couple weeks before we had our first case on the East Coast. And we're meeting with Microsoft on our digital alliance with Syracuse University and the city of Syracuse and Onondaga County. How can we really get this moving forward? And we were actually talking about this platform that it's called Aware, that it's used a lot for emergency management and public safety and health. And it's really an amazing platform, but that's what we wanted to get going. I wish we had it in before the pandemic. And so we're talking about this, and I'm in Seattle, right? And the virus was probably impacting us right then, and we didn't really know it. And so then I traveled back, and then went to Washington, D.C. for a NACO conference, our National Association of Counties. So I'm joined by my peers from across the country, and we're speaking to Onondaga County's early childhood initiatives, and we're being recognized nationally, and we're talking about what we're doing. And Kings County, Washington's county executive, Dean Constantine, is supposed to be on the panel with me, and then the Grand Rapids county executive. And we get there, and it's a Sunday, so I flew down Sunday morning. I get there, and we're presenting, and Dean Constantine from Kings County flies in, gets to the hotel, and it was the hotel that President Reagan was shot at. I forgot the name of it, but comes in, but then immediately gets a call and has to leave. And it was odd and curious. So we went on with that, and then later on, I asked, "Well, what happened? Everything okay?" And things weren't okay. That's when the first nursing home was impacted in Seattle. And so their county executive flew in, was going to be at this conference, got the word, flew out right away. And then at that point for the conference, all these leaders, this was a very real thing. We were meeting with the CDC, came over and talked to us. Our New York delegation got a briefing at the White House. And we just didn't know a lot. We knew some things, but didn't know that much. And then that evening, I went to many of the New York delegation, went to AIPAC, which is the Israeli Political Action Committee, a bipartisan political action committee. And at AIPAC, I'm meeting various individuals and leaders. The next day, I went home, flew home with a lot of Syracuse University students who were actually there on the same plane. And so we get back, and I tell these stories because a couple days later, patient zero from Westchester County gets sick, and then things blow up. And so I was in Seattle, Washington, when the virus was probably there. We just didn't know it yet. Then in DC and then AIPAC, patient zero from Westchester was at AIPAC. And he was in the same area in the delegation. And so I dodged early contacts. We actually were somewhat contact traced back then. And I never had exposure with the individual. But from there, we saw what was happening in Westchester. We were talking with our leaders, my colleagues from Long Island, Westchester County, the state, Mayor de Blasio. And we had about 3 weeks to plan and prepare and then actually implement mitigation. And so that's what we did on the first wave. Because of that, we probably avoided huge spikes like the rest of the state. Our positivity rate, which is what we were judging everything by, it's a little different now, got up to about 12%. Other parts of the state, that positivity rate was in the 40s. And so our geography helped us. The 2 to 3 weeks helped us. We started canceling potential super spreader events at the St. Patrick's Day Parade. We got a testing site up and running before we had a case. That was critical because that in the beginning, PPE was the issue. The test kits were the issue. We didn't have them. Everybody was fighting for them. And so we had that. We were quickly identifying the virus in our community, and that really helped us. And then certainly we went through a process of restrictions at points. We asked for more out of the community because we didn't know a lot about the virus and we didn't know how it would respond. And the community really responded. We then went through a process of restarting the economy, which is much more difficult than saying shut down. How do you restart the economy? What are rules and regulations that you have to try to open up businesses, do it in a safe way that isn't going to lead to additional spikes and loss of life? That was a challenge, that finding a balance. That's the one thing in this process, that finding a balance with the overall health of the community and recognizing that public health is not just COVID-19, and what decisions are we making on the public health that could drive other negative outcomes. When you think about mental health and suicide, the rates are really alarming from the pandemic. And then you look at opioid and addiction issues, really, really alarming rates that are directly related to the pandemic. So this is a balance. And so in the restart process, everybody was scared, even the state a little bit, because if you think about it, the common thought would be that as you turn on the valve of activity, the pressure would be for rates to go up. And actually the opposite kind of happened. Part of that was probably seasonal. People could be outdoors again. Part of it was the restrictions. And part of it was people, I think, had something to gain. Therefore, they had the mental aspect of, you think about the carrot and stick approach. The carrot approach really helped people dive in and do the right things, in my opinion. The state was actually very cautious with the restart, because I think everybody couldn't really believe what they were witnessing, is that when we went through each phase of restart, the data got better. It didn't get worse. And so that was an interesting process. There's a lot of behind the scenes maneuvering, and sometimes the goalposts were moved on the rules from us a little bit. But we always thought that the best approach as an executive who's trying to lead in a time where nobody else has ever had to, and the only other people that can really understand the pressure that we were under were my colleagues who are county executives, and certainly other executives who had to make some of these decisions, but the governor and then even the federal government. So, you know, I kind of made it my policy that we weren't going to Monday morning quarterback decisions from my partners in this process, because I knew we would make some mistakes. And I knew that these were folks who were under the same type of pressure I was under, which was really immense. So we got through that, and we had a great summer, and we had a great fall. And then we kind of fell asleep. Then you have the reality that the virus came back into our community, really probably through travel. And then you have conditions that really led to a situation. You could probably hear my son Andrew in the background. He'll probably be joining our Zoom call soon. And then with those conditions, getting cold, going indoors, we let our guard down. Then you had Halloween, and Halloween was a huge surge. It put us on a trajectory as far as caseloads that we probably won't get back from until February. As far as we're used to 40, 50, 60 cases a day, then Halloween brings us up to the 200 range, 225, 250. Thanksgiving brought us another surge. It looks like it hasn't been as bad as what people thought it could be. I really give the public the credit for that. I know some people in the public are very concerned. They see higher cases. The reality is, if you look at where we are compared, you can't compare to where we were in the summer. The virus wasn't here, essentially. You got to compare us to where we are with our peers and how can we improve from that. And so when you look at our peers within New York State, out of the 10 big counties, we're probably, if not the best today with our rates, we're probably the second best. Monroe County, they're 500, 600 cases a day. Erie County, 600, sometimes 700 cases a day. Long Island's picked up. When you look at Oneida County next door, Tony Pacenti, one of my good friends. They're half our size, actually a little less than half, and their caseloads are pretty close to where ours are. So we've actually weathered this, even though it doesn't feel like it. And it's really tough. And so here's what we know about the caseloads. We know that this is truly a gathering and a spread within indoor settings, and it's not commercial indoor settings anymore. Part of that's because some of the regulations put on bars have impacted their ability to operate. So that activity has actually just shifted. Part of it is your normal gatherings with your pods, right? We talk about people with their pods, be with the same people, socialize with the same people, your family. Well, we still go out, we still go to work, we still go to the grocery store, there's still a level of risk. And then we come back to our pod. And I was just in a quarantine because I had an immediate family member who got sick. So even my pod has been impacted. And so all this happens, you have Thanksgiving, people come together with people they know and they love, but some of those folks have had exposure. And that's what's driving these cases. And then you have others who, quite frankly, they aren't amenable to changing. I don't even think it's COVID fatigue at this point. I think it's COVID, I don't care. And so that's part of this. And so what are some of the things that we can do to really try to, as a community, slow this spread? And I think when you look at slowing it, one, you got to stay at home when you're sick. You cannot, any symptoms, you have to rule out COVID. That helped really expedite this pre-Halloween. We saw a lot of that. A lot of our, again, it's something that we're not used to. We're used to toughing it out, get to work, get the job done. I can get through this. We can't do that in the pandemic. The second is the gatherings. We really need to be careful moving forward. Really reassess your holiday gathering, your plans. Again, even in your own pod, there's a level of risk. Third is testing. We have so much testing available now, asymptomatic testing. Those are rapid tests at the on-center. We go into the community. We've been doing them in the schools. Please take advantage of that as much as you can. As long as we have test kits, please go and get tested. If you have symptoms, you got to go to the FSHAD or the Syracuse Community Health Center or the fairgrounds, because that type of test deals with symptoms better and you can identify it. But the testing is how we find the virus. So the only way we can flatten this is we have to find as much of it as we can so that we can isolate it and starve it. And so people get nervous when they see high case days. If I see a high case day, but I have a lot of tests, that doesn't bother me as much as when I have a low number of tests and a high case day. So what can we do? You need to get tested. Limiting your commercial activity at this point. I know people, it's the holidays, people are shopping. Try to do it all in one day. So you limit the risk that you have when you're out. And these are all things that we can do. And if everybody in the public did them, we'll flatten out where we are. And then eventually we're going to start to bend it again. But the positivity rate is how we've kind of graded this to this part. Now we have a vaccine. We have we'll have at least three. We have two of them where we'll actually have doses with Moderna and Pfizer in the next 3 weeks. And so it shifts. We're in if this is a basketball game, we're in the third quarter, maybe even headed towards the fourth. And so it shifts to our ability to treat our sick. At the same time, knowing that if you let caseloads get out of control, you won't be able to treat your sick because it's just math. About 8% of our active cases become hospitalizations. So we got to kind of control that caseload. At the same time, it's all about hospital capacity. And so we're having daily calls with the hospitals. Building beds or beefing up beds or ICU beds is never really the challenge. It's staffing these beds now. The same people who were doing the work in the beginning of the pandemic, they never stopped working. They've been working overtime this whole process. They're tired. They're run down. And every part of the country is facing the same pressure. So there's no nurses from other communities that are coming in to help out. Every community kind of has to grind this thing out together within your own community. And so that's really where this is. So when you look at some of the restrictions, the state started doing this micro cluster approach when they thought we were going to have micro clusters. And so you saw an orange zone or a yellow zone. The reality is the whole country would be in a massive zone right now. The whole state probably should be in a yellow zone right now. If you're going to look at it, these aren't micro issues anymore. They're macro. And so I think what we'll see is hopefully the state, unlike the beginning of the first wave, there's probably not a commercial regulation we can do that's going to just make this go from 300 cases a day to 150, because most of the cases are coming out of people's homes. So, you know, what can you do? You use the data, you regulate the industries that are driving cases, and then those that we thought might drive cases and they're not, you got to loosen up those regulations because these people have no money. You're creating other issues. You think about salons. We know, and I think even the governor's getting there, we know that nobody's getting this in salons. This we've had 12,000 cases. You know, you could probably attribute a case or two to a salon if we really wanted to. But when you look at drivers, that's not happening. Gyms, it's not happening in gyms. We specifically look. And part of that's because a lot of people haven't gone back to the gym because they're nervous. But the other thing is that the settings are very regulated. And then within school buildings, everybody's got it on this. We have so much data on this, and we're doing so much asymptomatic testing. Remember, the kids who are sick and the faculty who are sick shouldn't be in the building anyways. So it's the kids that are there. We're going in and doing so much testing. The positivity rates are under 0.5%, right? So when you look at our positivity rate in the community is probably in the 5 to 6% range, which if we were a state would be the fifth best state in the country. But in the buildings, it's not, right? So you take the data and then you blend in your policy as far as how to try to regulate this. But the reality is it's difficult. This is the peak season for this virus. It's flourishing in these conditions. When we saw this virus on the back end of winter, it was probably easier to deal with the virus then. So, you know, this second wave is very hard. And I'll get into just kind of the economic impacts now, because I think it's important that we realize like how this has really affected us moving forward. And for me, how has it impacted my agenda of trying to limit and eradicate poverty and modernize our infrastructure, which by doing that, that's going to drive economic opportunity. So we run government on sales tax. Our friends in the federal government, state government told us in the spring, you need to shut down your communities. That's a mandate, and it's an unfunded mandate because they never gave us any money to do it. And so by doing that, that set our 2020 budget in really a downward cycle, because we were growing at 5% revenue growth with sales tax, which is that's over 50% of our revenue. We have a $1.2 billion budget. So we're growing at 5, right? That's going to be a good year. We're going to be able to do a lot of good things. Legislator Chase is only going to take great votes at the legislature. She's not going to have to take tough votes. And then the pandemic happens, and all of a sudden we go from growing at 5 to negative 40. Really things that are just unheard of. And so we eventually get the economy open again and rolling again, and that negative 40 gets better and better and better. But when you look at negative 8 or negative 7, kind of where we are now, what does that mean? That's $40 million. That's mid-year. We didn't even have the ability to try to raise revenue. We're mid-year. So what decisions do you have to make? We have to make decisions about how we can use our reserves to help meet that goal. And in the meantime, that there's your negative 40, right? The state, because they're going through the same process, the state has withheld $20 million from us, right? So this could be a cut. So you're looking at $60 million that you got to just fix. So we start austerity measures. We start hiring freezes in March. We start our part-time lines. We don't fill those positions, but it's still not enough. And as time goes on, we make up ground. We just don't make up enough ground. And so we had to do another early retirement incentive, which was very helpful to help avoid layoffs. We did have some furloughs. I think we had about 30 furloughs eventually and 7 layoffs. But our positions that we had in 2019 compared to 2020, we had 500 fewer positions. And we're doing more work than we've ever done. Because anytime the governor puts out an idea or a ruling, on a regulation, they're not the ones enforcing it. We are. We're the ones in the health department doing all the work. They're a regulatory agency. They come up with rules. So it's just a remarkable experience. So 2020, we're going to probably have to use some of our reserves to balance that book. So now you go into 2021. What are the assumptions you have to make? The assumptions you have to make is we don't know what's going to happen in Q1 with our sales tax. We're going to assume a little bit of growth. We don't know if the state of New York is going to cut us $20 million again next year. And we know that we lost all that sales tax, and it'll take a decade for us to get it back. So we started out really the 2021 budget in a scenario where we had a massive hole. And, so we held the line on some of the tough decisions we made in 2020 helped us in 21, but we have departments that are doing more with less. It's amazing the amount of work they're doing. And maybe if we get some stimulus, we'll be able to shore up some of those departments. But the reality was, is we put out the biggest bare bones budget this county's ever had. All of our funds, we put out a budget that was $80 million less than last year. Our general fund, $50 million. So these weren't decisions we wanted to make. These were decisions that were necessary because we have a reserve. We're going to have to use some of that reserve in 20. We're only allowed, the legislature has a 10% fund balance goal. So our reserves are only about $10 million over that number. And then if you use your reserves, here's the kicker, right? We're just, think about your own personal credit score, right? That you use your credit to go get a mortgage, to get a car. And sometimes if you've got a bad credit, you can't get a mortgage or a car. And if you have questionable credit, you can get one, but you're going to pay more money. So we're the same way. And the rating agencies, our friends at Fitch and Moody's, if you use your fund balance and they don't have a fund balance, that shows them that you don't have the ability to pay your bills in another rainy day. So then you can't go bond. And so you can't, the option that some have suggested that you can just spend your whole fund balance in the rainy day today, then that means you don't think there could be a rainy day tomorrow. And then when you need to fix a bridge or fix your roads, or we run wastewater systems, we bond for those things. We borrow. If you blow through your reserves, your credit score is going to get run down to the point where you'll be borrowing junk bonds, and fiscally, we're not prepared for the future then. So I've spoken for a little bit. I'd love to take questions. Emily, let me know what we got.
Yeah, well, so we'll start with the first question from the chat. I'm going to quote from this person. They agree with you that mental health issues as a result of this pandemic are huge, especially with young people. So can you please explain why the county budget is not putting more money into social services that would be critical moving forward?
Well, I just told you. Remember, when you say social services, that's me. That's my department. These are my people that work for me. When you are facing a 20% state cut in these, and that's where, so when I say a 20% state cut, this is where the state funds, okay? So they don't cut you areas, they don't give you money. They fund us in our health department. They're cutting our health department. They fund our social services. They fund our children and family services. They fund our adult and long-term care. So this is all a reflection on the reality of where we are. We can't, our ability to grow revenue at the local level, it just isn't there. We have a 2% property tax cap. So when you have our only revenue get smashed the way it did with sales tax, then you have your state government, who you run their programs essentially, cutting you 20%, you're not going to be able to fund at the levels you want to fund. That's just the reality. It's not the reality we want. We've been screaming for stimulus relief to the heavens, and continue to do that with my colleagues. I was on two national calls calling for federal action to get the state some help, because they need help too. But also to get direct funding to the counties. Certainly, if we get some direct help, we'll be able to shore up some of those departments that have been impacted. But I think it's important for people to understand, though, when you talk about these departments, that's me. I'm the executive. Those are my departments. When there's a problem, I'm managing the problem.
Thank you. All right. We've got two questions that are kind of similar, so we're going to combine them. Do you anticipate any relief from the federal government? And then what changes with a new federal administration are you kind of foreseeing?
Yeah, so we're at a critical juncture for relief. The stakes are really, really high. The Problem Solvers Caucus in the House got together with six senators, bipartisan, and really did a great job boxing in the leaders. The leaders have been the problem this whole time on both parties. Because they have different constituencies. Some want to just help out certain areas. Some want to help out broad-based, but never really feasible. So you're putting together two proposals that everybody knows would fail. So that just wastes time, and we don't have time. So state local aid is a piece of this. It's not enough, but the concept is if we can get something, it will get us through the vaccine distribution period, and that potentially with President Biden coming in, there'll be more of an effort to shore up state and locals down the road, because you really can't have an economic recovery if one of your biggest employers is letting go of people, and those people help get other people who aren't working ready to work. So that's what we do in local government. So so I think if we don't get a deal done here soon, and part of why these senators from other states don't say they should help state and locals is a function of how the local governments make money, right? So if some of these states and my colleagues across the country haven't been impacted fiscally at all, right? So they get just property taxes. And their property taxes have been going up because they're in thriving communities in Texas and Tennessee. And so they haven't felt it. So their senators are saying, why do I want to go bail out these other states that they do things differently? My people are okay. So that's the why. There's certainly a lot of politics too, right? A ton of politics. But I think there's a chance. There's a 50-50 chance. And we would get some direct funding. It's not going to solve our issues. It will probably help us cover the second wave costs a little bit. Maybe we can do a couple things that other communities have done. The one thing I do want the people to understand, and they've heard me say this, we have been, I would say, if this was at the evening and I had a beer in my hand, I'd use another word right now, but we have been disproportionately harmed. The CARES Act funding, 48 out of the 50 states for communities under 500,000 people. If you were over 500,000 people, you got direct aid from the government. That's a HUD funding formula. If you're under 500,000, the money went through the states. 48 out of the 50 states gave that money to their local governments. Well, ours didn't. That's $80 million that was owed to Onondaga County that we didn't get. And if you think about, I was on a call with Cook County's county executive, Chicago, Illinois, last night. She's got a great program with legal aid, working on trying to stem off evictions for a housing crisis. One of my partners in a small county in Kentucky, Boone County, Kentucky, right by Cincinnati there, they're doing a huge broadband initiative, all being paid for with CARES Act funding. These are things that we have the same problems, but we didn't get the money sent to us. And I can assure you, we haven't gotten $80 million of support. So we are really pushing for direct aid to counties, and cities would get support as well. Even though in New York, the cities don't have a health department, so they don't have all the impacts we've had. Our city's been impacted certainly by sales tax, just like we have, and some of the regulatory standpoints as well. And certainly housing is going to be a big issue. But if we had that money, our deficit going into 2021 was $84 million. Think about it. We were owed 80 million bucks. So when you look at all of this, hopefully this happens. And we were the second largest county in the country that did not get direct funding because of this formula. I do think having President-elect Biden coming in, look, he has a tie to Onondaga County. He grew up, he lived in my neighborhood, in Strathmore neighborhood, for a little bit. I think that helps his family ties of his first wife here, and then Syracuse University. These are all things that I think you can build on a little bit, and certainly will give you a level of access. I think infrastructure is a way, somewhere where this current administration talked about wanting to get something done. I think that's a policy issue that can bring the country together. I think it's something that hopefully the new administration focuses in on. We are in a very, very hyper-political time, and partisanship is a cancer. And hopefully the new administration, with some of his relationships from the Senate, can help mend some of these fences.
Thank you so much. Next question. I'm going to quote from this person. Is it possible to get rapid testing for employees at hospitals? They recently learned of a couple people who went into hospitals for other reasons but ended up with COVID.
So the rapid test, we have asymptomatic rapid tests right now. So at the on center, and then we're going out into the community and doing them. It's an antigen test. The medical community doesn't really like it for symptoms. They like the PCR test. So the problem with the rapids for those, and Syracuse knows this. I've been trying to upstate all of our partners. We can't buy enough of them. So I've been trying to buy them. There's a test called the Abbott ID Now. It's, if you have symptoms, it's a rapid test. I have 10 machines. They won't let me buy them. Abbott won't. I want to buy them. I want to go give them a $2 million order. I can't buy them because they can't make them fast enough for the country right now. So it's really a supply chain issue. If you're asymptomatic and you guys have exposure, you could get one of our asymptomatic tests. Dr. Gupta might yell at me for saying that, because you're supposed to, with exposure, go and get a nasal swab. But we do have those. Those are really beneficial. We're finding positive cases in the community every day that we wouldn't have if we weren't doing this. And again, testing in the beginning of this, anybody could get a test. Insurance is covering it. What changed? And this hurt us in the fall. This put us back a little bit in the fall. What changed was insurance stopped covering asymptomatic testing. They only covered the symptomatic testing. So once you're sick, it's already, sometimes it's too late when you look at spread. So now we're identifying all the hidden clusters in the community, and this will help us in the long run. But we are trying to buy more symptomatic rapid tests. We know it will help make our job a lot easier. We're the ones who got to do the investigations and the tracing. If we know right away you have it, we can isolate you quickly. We don't need to wait 3-4 days to be able to isolate you and hope that you're at your home, you're not out in the community potentially spreading it.
Thank you. Next question, we're going to shift away from COVID. Can you explain the deal with Moonbeam with Shopping Town? When we develop slash sell the property, will we pay Moonbeam some funds? Don't they owe us?
Yeah, so here's where that is. So we in Allegheny County hold towns and villages and school districts harmless of tax collection. So think about that. If you're them, the town assesses. So they assess the property. We then give them a check for their assessed value. Then we have to go chase the property owner. In this case, a very bad actor, Moonbeam. Moonbeam owns the property, right? Just they're the owners of the property. The property has value. We have been paying out to the town of DeWitt and the Jamesville DeWitt School District millions of dollars. My administration, when I became county executive, said enough. We're going after them. We're going to try to take the property and give it to the OSIDA so they can go have a process so we can make it a performing asset in the community again. Moonbeam blocked that transfer. We went to court. We were successful. Then we went to the next court. They appeal. And I think we were successful again. And then they're down to their last option that they have, which is their legal right, which is bankruptcy court. So we forced them into bankruptcy court. Now, bankruptcy court is implicitly biased towards the individual in bankruptcy. The job of bankruptcy court is to try to look to restructure to make this entity solvable basically make them whole to a degree. So in bankruptcy court, we went at this for a while. A couple of things became very apparent. One, over the last 3 years, this property was overassessed, and that no matter what, the judge was going to lower the assessment, which would mean the amount of money owed to the county for Moonbeam would be dramatically less. It wouldn't be $10 million plus penalties and interest. It would be dramatically less than that. And so is the county still owed money? Yes, we are. Who owes us the money then? The town of DeWitt owes us the money, and the Jamesville DeWitt School District owes us the money. So from the county's perspective, the judge put a temporary assessment in of $4 million. It was at 33. So that was temporary, but even if it's worth more than four, which it is, it's not worth 33. So what Moonbeam actually owed the county was going to be a lot less. We know that's a fact. So the judge then wants us to go into mediation. So what are our goals as a community? Our goals are to divorce ourselves of this relationship with Moonbeam, to get site control, to get an investment in that property so it can become a regional asset, and to get some of our money back. So how do you do it? So Moonbeam was very much willing to do a fire sale. Let's just go in, we'll sell it together for the highest bidder. That's not in our interest. We could get somebody else coming in, buying it for a good price. We get our payoff now, but in the future, they stop making payments because they don't invest in the property again. So what we did is we negotiated with the mediator that the judge put forward, a deal where it really accomplishes the goals we had. And our goal number one being site control. So Moonbeam owns it, there is value. So we had to work on a purchase price. So the purchase price would be $3.5 million to Moonbeam up front. The town of DeWitt and the school district would pay a third of that. The county would pay the 2/3. And the county would then take the property. We would then go out and put out an RFP for proposals nationally. We will have certain criteria, certain things we want to see looked at with the property, mixed use, potentially housing, town center, employer. All these things will be incorporated into the RFP. We put it out. Then when it comes back, part of that is they have to buy the property, right? So there's then a scale. So I believe if I'm correct, the first $4 or $5 million on a sales price, the county gets 90 cents on the dollar, Moonbeam gets 10 cents on the dollar. Then think about this like a tax bracket, okay? So then from the 5 million to the 12 million, that range, the county gets 80 cents and Moonbeam, I think it's 20 cents. And then the 12 and a half to like 16 and a half, we get 70 cents, they get 30 cents. And then anything over 16 and a half, which is highly unlikely, it flips. Moonbeam, so say it sells for 20, the $3.5 million between 16 and a half and 20, Moonbeam gets 80 cents, we get 20 cents. That's highly unlikely that will happen. So the reality is Moonbeam is going to get some money out of this. We're going to get probably most of the money back that Moonbeam and DeWitt owe to us. It's just going to take longer. But for us, the key is that that's a performing asset for the community in the east side of our county. And that moving forward, we have somebody who's going to pay their bills. And so we think the deal we negotiated will accomplish that.
Thank you. Next question. We have been through some hard times, even more difficult challenges are ahead. The negatives are clear. That said, is there anything we are learning from this experience that might help us once we get through to the other side?
I think we are. There's certainly a lot of positives that come from this. When you have great challenges in front of you, you know, to meet those challenges is significant. It's a significant accomplishment. So when you look at just from what our community is doing in meeting these challenges, there's just a lot of value there. There's a lot of upside. When we look at where our poverty platform, a big piece of it, we talked about kind of our pillars of what that looked like for 2 years to the public. Health was a big component of this. We never thought we would need it for a 100-year pandemic. But from the health standpoint, I feel much more comfortable in how we can get at root causes of poverty through health now today than I did before. The underlying condition that we talk about, which that individual who has it, some of those are from systems that can be addressed, right? Some of those underlying conditions are just the way we're born, but others are not. And so what can we do to address those? I feel we're more prepared now to do that on the other side of this pandemic. I think there's better economic opportunities. I think this woke up the country to the fact that you can't have supply chains to all your public health related pharmaceuticals and whatnot in other countries. You just can't. The global relationships are too fragile. So some of these other countries that we're very dependent on, with China and others, are just they don't share our interests. And in many cases, they don't share our values. So we need to repatriate that. What are the opportunities then that we have in Central New York? The same opportunities why somebody should be here for a large logistics facility, they should be here for a large manufacturing facility. So I think there's a lot of economic opportunity for us. It's also highlighted for me some of the challenges that we had that we wanted to work on, but now we understand how important it is when you think of broadband access and the digital divide. We were working on short-term approaches to that problem with things like our tech pack program in libraries and working here or there. Now I think we have to go big, and we have to fix the problem now. The short's not going to work. We've seen how important it is to be connected. So these are all things that there's opportunity, but also things that bring clarity. And these experiences, I think, leave us more prepared and more driven to get better outcomes on those.
Great, thank you. So you just talked about broadband as one example. Do you have, virtual learning has definitely shown that there's just not equal access out there. Do you have a plan on, you know, what we can do after all this is over?
Yeah, I think there's two divides we really have to address, and we can't wait, right? So this is something that we need to get done, and we're going to get done. One, our rural access is it's gotten better, but it's gotten better with the at the whims of the private markets, which haven't gone far enough. And so we need to play a role in this infrastructure in the government with investments, because this is important to us as roads to the digital divide becomes an affordability issue in other parts of our community, in our urban centers. So very interested with the mayor, working with the mayor. They've done some things through the surge platform with the street lighting grid, with hotspots and sensors. How do we take that infrastructure and bring that access to households in our poor neighborhoods and throughout our city? That will be an economic development opportunity as well. So the we have our rural poor communities and our urban core communities that have really been impacted significantly. So I don't think, I think the idea that we can't, government can't make an investment in this, you got to let the private markets do it. The private markets have kind of failed to a degree on this. It's gotten better, but we need to get in the game.
Great, thank you. Next question, has any forecasting and projections on the economic impact on the small business community, Main Street, happened and anticipated loss of small businesses, especially in the hospitality and other hardest hit segments?
Yeah, it's tough to forecast out what it's going to look like. We're very concerned. The hospitality industry is just taking a beating. And so the PPP program round one worked out well. They really need this PPP round two. Some of these businesses we talked about didn't really qualify. A salon owner is probably an independent contractor. They never qualify for PPP. Again, cases aren't attributed there. Those folks got to get working. We got to adapt. We got to use the data to make good decisions in government. That's not the answer hospitality wants to hear. But the restaurants and bars were a driver, the consistent driver over the summer. Even though there wasn't a big driver, they were the driver. And then certainly they contributed in a big way to the Halloween surge as well. So there's more risk there. So we need to be there to help them get through this so that they're there. You can't have Main Street in downtown without hospitality. And so we've worked out with some of our IDA loans. We've done some OC, some of our civic development loans. I signed an executive order yesterday, which... it's interesting. I signed this order and now all these big tech companies want to talk to me, but the, basically saying what was happening to our small businesses, is that your Grubhubs and, I think your DoorDashes were charging 30% for them to go deliver the food. That takes away all the margin. They can't make any money. The only way that it makes sense to participate in that is for these small business owners. It helps them actually at least give their cooks something to do, and so they don't lose their workforce. So I signed an executive order yesterday. Mayor Walsh, very good supporter, was pushing me to do this, saying that we're capping those fees at 15%. And so certain New York City's done something similar. Monroe County down the street and Rochester's done something similar. So it's not something that we want. That was never a spot I'd want to be in, regulating fees in markets. But right now we're in a spot where some of the only economic activity these industries have will be takeout and will be essentially delivery. If there's no margins there for them in the delivery, they have no interest to keep the cooks employed, and they'll just shut their doors down. So we're looking every way we kind of support these industries and these hospitality industries. And I think they will get help from the federal government. Eventually the federal government will have to help the airlines. It's going to have to help hospitality. I think you'll help some of our other, you know, socialized based businesses like theaters and music venues. The question is, does your local and state governments get help? And if we don't get help, it will still impact those industries because we fund some of those industries. And we can't fund the arts if we don't have any money. So this is all cyclical. But I do. Those are industries that have gotten absolutely crushed in the second wave.
Next question about vaccines. We know you don't have, you know, direct say in how those are distributed. But do you anticipate any issues coming from the vaccine coming to Onondaga County?
So we'll have doses coming in for two different populations. We're going to have regional spots with hospitals that will hold the Pfizer vaccine. It needs to be in a very chilled setting. So you'll have hospitals that have those freezers will be kind of regional outputs. Those will go to essential healthcare professionals who are interacting with the virus, most exposure. Second, the federal government, the military essentially has come up with a partnership with Walgreens and CVS. Nursing homes have the ability to, they've had to reach out to one of these and develop a partnership. These then pharmacies are going to go into nursing homes and they will give the vaccine to a third of the employees, not all the employees at once, because the vaccine could have side effects and you could have workforce going out for a period of time. But then any of the residents that have agreed to take the vaccine. And this is the progress. This is the one thing that makes me happy is 25% of our hospitalizations right now, nursing home residents. The virus found its way back there. When you look at who we're losing in our community right now, we're losing people in nursing homes every day now in the nursing home. But even our hospital numbers, the folks who we're losing, 75% of them are nursing home residents. So when you talk about the people that are we're losing in this war, this is going to help them next week. So that's like that makes me smile. So this is those are the two areas right away. Moderna, the second dose of Pfizer, the Pfizer vaccine can be 50% effective on the first dose, which is great. Second dose is going to be in 3 weeks. So you think about next week, and this is happening 3 weeks from now, the second dose will come to those same people. Then Moderna's coming in shortly thereafter. I think you'll see more frontline workers with the Moderna. After Moderna, we may be in a pretty good spot with those two groups of having all those groups vaccinated. And then you look at the next group. But we're going to have a huge outreach campaign on the vaccine and specifically in our minority communities and in our new American communities as for us to essentially get our way of life back in 2021 as fast as we can. We need to get to that 70%, 75% vaccination rate.
Great, thank you. We have time for one more question. So, if MPA programs or Masters in Public Administration or similar type programs add a course in managing through this type of crisis, what should be in the curriculum?
Oh man. I think that what I learned early on in this crisis is that if anybody wants to give me credit for anything in it, it's that I hired good people. And when you look at Dr. Gupta and you, Dr. Gupta, by the way, is the best public health commissioner in New York State, and she's ours. Or she's a rock for her peers, and they lean on her as much as I do. But when you look at Anne Rooney and Dan Wiers and some of these folks that all of a sudden one day are doing one thing, the next day they're working on continuity of food programs for our seniors. It's just amazing the workforce. So you are as good as the people who you surround yourself with. I think the one thing that we've always done in this pandemic that's played well for us, and during the pandemic, even to this day, I have people screaming at me on both sides of this, saying you need to shut everything down, or you're a moron. Why isn't everything open? So every day, no matter where I am, whether it's calls, emails, Twitter. But if you use the data doesn't care about political affiliation. The data tells the story. And then if you make data-based decisions, you can sleep at night. And that's what's really the key here is that, surround yourself with great people, use the data, learn from everybody else. Don't be scared to make a decision when the data tells you need to make one, even if it's going to be unpopular, because the people, I think, at the end of this, even if they disagree with decisions you make, if you're doing it in a consistent manner. And then the third thing that I think is the number one thing that we've really tried to do is we've communicated and we've done our briefings. We've been accessible and we communicate not just here's the data, goodbye, here's what's going on, but we communicate the decisions we make and why we've made them. And then when people feel read in, they're more likely to buy into what you're trying to accomplish for the community.
Great, thank you so much. Unfortunately, we are out of time. So please join me in thanking County Executive for speaking with us today and through leading us through this very difficult time. Thank you.
Thanks, everybody. Good seeing you all.